Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Poker Hall of Famer Billy Baxter, who last appeared on our show January of 2015. If you find today's show interesting, which I'm pretty sure you will, you'll find it worth your while to check out the former one. You can find it on bobdancer.com. You can find it on YouTube and a few other places. Among other things, the earlier show talks about a tax ruling made in a Billy Baxter case that benefits all Advantage players today. We'll speak to Billy in a few minutes. This past weekend, Bonnie and I attended the Mob Museum in downtown Las Vegas for the first time. We only spent 3 hours there due to something we had to do afterwards, and we could have spent more. It was just north of the downtown Grand in the old federal courthouse, where there were some actual Kefauver hearings related to the mob back in the early 1950s. Partly because of preparing for various guests on this show, I've read tons about various mob figures and their history to Las Vegas. One of these mobsters, Tony Spilotro, is a featured part of one of Billy Baxter's stories later in today's show. I haven't studied the mob so much in other cities, but this museum has it all, Vegas and everywhere else, including lots of interactive displays and short films. There were some pretty cool exhibits, including the actual wall from the 1929 St. Valentine's Day massacre. Pretty interesting afternoon. I recommend it. Although we got in free because it was a Caesar 7-star weekend benefit, the price is between $20 and $25, which shouldn't be a showstopper for anyone coming to Vegas. Richard, have you been to that museum?
You know, I have not yet. I've heard nothing but great things. Everyone I know who goes says how much they liked it. I keep meaning to do it, and I just haven't gotten around to doing it. So it is something I really want to do. And maybe our talking about it will inspire me to actually get down there and get that done. I did see the original place of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre growing up outside Chicago. And we had a neighbor who was a mechanic in that shop and was supposed to be there that morning. And he was in a poker game or something and got delayed and got down there after the murders had happened. And I remember my grandmother telling me that his hands would shake so bad that she could only fill his drink halfway because for the rest of his life, he just had the shakes.
Jeffrey Compton's uncle, granduncle, grandfather, something, was somehow related to the St. Valentine's Day massacre. Maybe next time he's on the air, we can ask him about that. I'm positive Jeffrey isn't connected in any way, but he's related to somebody who was. We received an email addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com about the difference between super times pay video poker and double super times pay. Our emailer wants to know which one is better. Super times pay is a 6-coin per line game, where every 15 hands, you get a multiplier between 2x and 10x. It doesn't change the strategy on the game and adds about 0.25% with a small increase in variance. Double super times pay is a 7 coins per line game where you potentially receive multipliers on 2 separate occasions, the deal and the draw. It doesn't change your strategy and adds about 0.5% to the return with a large increase in variance. If you put the features on a good game, say 9-6 jacks, which returns 99.5% to start with, this can be a pretty good game. If you put it on a game that starts out at 95%, well, adding either 0.25% or 0.5%, the game still sucks. If both super times pay and double super times pay can be found on the same pay schedule, double super times pay is the better choice by about 0.25%, assuming you can handle the variance. But even if it's the better game of the two, you need to know a lot more about the slot club,
mailers, and promotions to understand whether it's a good game to play. Let's speak to Billy Baxter.
Billy was born and raised in Georgia, and through the years has been a champion at shooting marbles, a pool hustler, a poker player, a gin rummy player, a bookie, a casino owner, a golf hustler, a very knowledgeable sports bettor, and a boxing trainer. Huh, that was a lot. And his great stories going about decades about each of these things. He has 7 World Series of Poker bracelets and was inducted into the Poker Hall of Fame in 2006. Billy Baxter, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
Well, good to be here.
You were successful at gambling before you came to Vegas. So why did you move here and when did this happen?
Well, I guess that's kind of how I got into the gambling business. I was going to college. Actually, I was going to be a dentist. And I went in a gambling casino, which is illegal in Georgia, so we won't call it a casino as we know them here. It was a very nice place, but it was in Augusta, Georgia, and gambling is completely illegal there in the state and everything. So,
except maybe on the golf course.
Yes. So I went in, and I wound up playing the guy that owned the place, Jim Rummy, and I won $40,000. And this is when I was, actually I wasn't 21, I was 20 years old. I wasn't old enough to come in there. And turns out, I look back on it, I think that was all the money they had, because at the end, they paid me the money. And then they had craps, roulette, blackjack, just like Vegas. They had a trailer out back. They had maybe 10 dealers that were all Las Vegas dealers that flew there and lived there. And the way they kept them there was very simple. They paid them triple wages.
Uh-huh, and this is approximately 1960, somewhere around there.
I'll tell you exactly when it was. This was 1960.
Oh, thank you.
So being as I was born in 40 and I was 20, that's when it was. And things were quite a bit different back in those days in the South. In other words, those places weren't everywhere, but there were a few around the country. Augusta had gambling, like this type of gambling, for quite a while. And anyway, I beat him out of the $40,000, and he says, well, you know all the good people around town. Why don't you think about going in business with us? And I said, well, what would that entail? And they said, well, oh, about $40,000. So that's when I got to thinking. But I got to thinking about it. I said, what am I going to do with $40,000? Going to college, this, that, and the other. So I didn't quit school right away, but I started coming down, and they made me a full partner. But at the end of every night, he'd count the money down. We'd split the money up. Everything went really good. He was a nice guy. And he said, well, let's see how the cards are running tonight. We'd start playing, and naturally, a few hours, I'd have all his end of the money. So basically, I had 100%. And this went on for like 2 years. Finally, and so I quit school a year and a half later. I mean, after 6 months, I quit school. I realized that, you know what, this might be
this
my
is your
calling.
Gold mine.
This is my calling. So by the time I was 21 years old, I'd gotten a hold of quite a bit of money for that time. And he finally come to me and he says, you know, Billy, he says, doesn't look like I'm going to ever have any money here being a partner with you. He says, I'm thinking about moving to Florida. Would you like to buy me out? And I paid him $250,000 for the other half. I remodeled the place, spent quite a bit of money. I mean, we had the best food anywhere. I mean, like, our food was all free, drinks, everything. And so I was there for, 2 to 3 years running this casino. And the sheriff in that county died, and the guy that took over came to me, which was nice of him, and he said, Billy, he says, I know you're a local boy. There's no organized crime involved here. You went to high school here. But I'm going to stop this gambling on my watch. He says, I'm not going to allow this to go on anymore. He said, you can either close up, or I'll be back to see you. Well, I believed him. So I closed it up, having spent all that money. But meanwhile, I had really made it back and a lot more. So then I come out of there and I decide, well, what am I going to do now? And I'd heard that people that were in the bookmaking business did pretty well, so I thought I'd give that a try.
Wait, and, just out of curiosity, I got to stop you for a second. How did you know so much about gambling at 20 years old? And well, and were you used to playing that high, that winning $40,000?
Well, what happened was I only had $2,000 when I started that night. And we started off playing for like, I was playing high $100 a hand, you know, for, with a $2,000 bankroll. But I had started playing pool when I was about 14 years old and gambling through that and all. And then I gradually, when I got 18, I started playing cards around a, there was a local bar in town where it wasn't a, because they didn't cut the pot or anything. All the local businessmen went there in the afternoon when they got off work. I'm talking about bankers, lawyers, whatever. And I got in there and I got in the game. And that's another story in itself. I had made my money from playing pool and I'd got in this poker game and they'd break me. I'd go back to the pool room, make some more money, and I'd go back again and they'd break me again. And I'd go back to the pool room, make some more money, and they'd break me again. So this went on for about 6 or 8 months, 17, 18, right in there. So finally, about 19, I began to turn the corner. I got a little better, and I started to win. And, of course, now I'm going to college. So I had some gambling background there. And so I wasn't just a novice when I came in that club that night. I was very good at gin rummy. And so anyway, I got in the bookmaking business. And going along with that business, I got on a wiretap out of Macon, Georgia, where I was getting the line. I really wasn't calling Las Vegas at that time, but he was calling Las Vegas and getting the lines and all, and I became part of a conspiracy, that's what they called it. And, but I got probation that time, federal probation, a felony along with a probation. Then, about 2 years later, the doors come down again, FBI, and I was involved with a wiretap out of Birmingham, Alabama, where I was calling over the state lines. And by that time, I was conducting business with people in Vegas and all over the world, for that matter. I'd gotten pretty big. And so now I got two felony convictions for bookmaking. No, I'm not convicted. I'm just indicted for the second one. So then I finally got my last urge to do something I probably shouldn't have. And I decided to open a little casino just for the Masters Golf Tournament that 1 week. And I leased a piece of property out on 150 acres, which was on the outskirts of town, and I fixed the place up with bar. Because back in those days, you had to protect yourself against the heist man, the burglars, whatever you want to call them. And a man from Atlanta, Georgia, who was a bookie up there, and he wasn't very well liked, but I didn't know that. He approached me and said, listen, if I bring a lot of good customers over for the Masters and I stand good for all the credit, can I have 25%? And I said, sure. So he brings all these people over. And the third night of the Masters Golf Tournament, it turns out he had been passing maps out all over Atlanta how to get to my place. And the GBI, which is the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, had gotten a hold of these maps. Anyway, they came over and they had the FBI join in with them. And anyway, they came in. They didn't get in too fast, though, because the place was fixed pretty good. They began trying to get in. And there were about 60 to 80 people in there, of which Sonny Jurgensen, the football player, was at Hall of Fame, incidentally. He had the craps in his hand when the doors came down. And anyway, I had took the checks that were people had written checks for shooting dice and all, you know. And we had this big, fat, black lady cook that was, had worked for me at the other place. She was in the kitchen. I went in and I said, Hattie, could you find somewhere to hide these checks? She said, yes, sir, Mr. Bill, don't worry. I'll take good care of it. So I give her all the checks. And, of course, now they come in and they've loaded two school buses up with 60 people, take them down to the sheriff's office. But when he came in, he took over because it was his jurisdiction. He decided to let everybody go, just take their names. They were all tourists, you know, which I said that originally out at the house. I wouldn't bother these people, let them go. They said, oh, you be quiet. You let us do our job. So I did what they said. So now we're downstairs. So I'm the only one they book. And so the next day, a sidelight to this, I went by Hattie's house to get my checks. And I go by, I said, Hattie, you got my checks? She said, oh, Mr. Bill, I got your checks. Don't worry. So she goes back in the bedroom. She comes out and she gives me a handful of checks. And the ink's running on them and they're all wet looking and all. You know, I said, Hattie, where'd you put these checks? She said, oh, Mr. Bill, I took my false teeth out and I put some in the roofs of my mouth. And she says, I took good care of your checks. So they will hardly recognize them, but I give them to this guy, Tyler, and he managed to get them all collected because the guys were all wealthy guys, rich people from all over the world. They were all honorable. And so I got charged with another felony there. So at that time I was engaged to be married, and I think your question was how I got started in gambling.
How did you get to Vegas, and when did this, and when did it happen? Vegas?
Well, I decided that my time was about over in Augusta, Georgia.
That sounds like it.
So I got married. Me and my wife, we flew to Hawaii on our honeymoon. We came back through Las Vegas, and we stopped at the Dunes Hotel, which is where the Bellagio is now.
Uh-huh.
We checked in. I already knew the people there, Sid Wyman, Major Riddle, Maurice Dodson, and I stayed in the Cary Grant suite for 9 months. The casino business was quite a bit different back in those days. They never charged me a penny for anything. But I played a lot of cards and gin rummy with Sid, and him and Major owned the place. So, you know, you pretty much do what you want to when you own the place. That's really how I got to Las Vegas. In the end of 9 months, I think he got tired of me staying in the hotel. He actually took my wife and I over to the Regency Towers, which is still there. But back in the day, that was a pretty good address. It's not anymore. And he sold me his condominium that he had never moved into. So that's how we got to Las Vegas.
All right.
You know, there was a lot of gin rummy back then. And even through the 70s and 80s, like I remember going into the Dunes poker room, and you guys would play gin right there in the poker room on a empty poker table. Is there still any gin action, and could you do that today? Could you sit down at the Bellagio at an empty table and play gin rummy?
They came up with in other words, if you don't have an approved poker game, you can't play that game. Even certain poker games, they won't deal at the casinos. If you have a new game, you have to get it approved by the gaming commission. Well, short cards, they wanted to discourage that. They found out they didn't make enough money off that. But the owners wanted to do it back when we were doing it, so they did what they wanted to. Just like they went in the cage. Back in those days, they played poker with us. When they wanted some money, they'd go back to the cage, they'd get $200,000, they'd bring it out, they'd sign a marker. I assume when the game was over, they'd go back in the cage and tear the marker up and throw it in the trash. I think that's what they did. But anyway, based on their results, that's probably they needed to do that to stay in money. But anyway, we played a lot of gin rummy there. The Dunes was kind of a hangout for that. And the best player in the world, without a doubt, was Stewie Unger.
Yep.
And anybody wants to argue that, the new modern players will argue that. There's a guy by the name of Abe Mazzaria, very good poker player. And he comes out and he plays in all the big games at the Bellagio and all. He argued me till he was blue in the face. He says that with the new things that these guys know now, and they've broken the game down so many different ways, he says Stewie wouldn't have a chance. But I beg to differ. I don't think anybody ever lived or ever will live that could beat Stewie playing gin rummy. He was not the best poker player in the world, and he was a terrible gambler. But gin rummy, the first day I met him, they took me to my room. They came to my room. He was so little, they had the wooden Coca-Cola boxes back in those days. They had to put two Coca-Cola crates in his chair for him to be up high enough to see the cards. He beat me out of 40,000 in a little time, and it didn't take me too long to realize. I was a pretty good player, too. I says, you know, Stu, I'm going to have to give you up, buddy. And he had two mob guys with him from New York. They had brought him out here. You know, that was, he was quite a guy.
So is there still gin rummy action today?
There's really not much gin rummy compared to what it was back then. It was really popular back in those days and all. And in fact, I haven't played in probably 20 years. Mm. But I used to play. I thought I played well. In fact, I did play well. I played all the good players in the world. And but the game kind of got away, and it's not as popular. But they don't allow you to play it, and that's one of the reasons they chased it away. You know, out of the casinos, put it out of sight.
Yeah, you would have to play at somebody's house.
You've
got to
go to the
country
house
club
or this, that, or the other. And,
speaking of gin at the country club.
Yeah, let me give a little bit of foundation for that. And we're definitely got a gin story at the country club. Mike Sexton, on our show not so long ago, he wrote a new book called Life's a Gamble. And he devotes an entire chapter to Billy Walters. Billy Baxter. Sorry about that. Billy Walters is a different person. Love to have him on the air. But Mike calls Billy the man about town and generally talks of Billy being a class act and a great storyteller. He tells about the tax case, which we spoke about last time Billy was on the air with us. And he told a couple other stories, and I'd like to hear Billy's take on them. Mike's storytelling isn't bad, but as Sexton says, Billy Baxter is a great storyteller. Okay. You, Chip Reese, and Doyle Brunson regularly played golf and also gin rummy at the Las Vegas Country Club back in the mid-80s. The Country Club is just east of what is now the Westgate, Las Vegas Hilton for many years. Now, Doyle frequently wanted gin, but one day you and Chip were beating him so badly, Doyle made unusual demands to make sure you and Chip weren't cheating him. What happened?
Well, I'm going to change this story around a little bit.
Okay.
Number one, Doyle and I, at the time, were partners in the bookmaking business.
Huh.
And we always bet against each other at everything, though. We go on the golf course. And the reason for that was simple. Doyle could never bet enough, no matter what you were playing. You never had enough on a football game. You never had enough. In other words, if he had $200,000 on the game before, if somebody bet him, you'd think that'd be sufficient. He'd always want to bet $50,000 on the game himself before it started. You know, I make him the all-time gotta-play guy.
Action junkie.
I didn't want to say that about my friend Doyle, but he knows it's true, so I don't feel too bad about saying it. Anyway, we're playing golf and all, and Chip had just come around. It wasn't like we were playing golf and all the time. He had just kind of come to town, and he was just kind of a guy on the sideline, so to speak. And this is like very early 80s. And so after we get off the golf course, Doyle says, well, let's see how the cards are running today. He says, I tell you what we're going to do today. We're going to play seven-card knock rummy, and you're going to take this kid here. He's going to be your partner. I'm going to play you and him. Play him one hand, you one hand. And so I says, and I knew that Chip was supposed to be a pretty good player, but I didn't even know a whole lot about Chip, to be honest. But I took him because I felt like at that game I could beat Doyle, and Chip was supposed to be a good player too. So anyway, we start playing. And we're playing like 1,000 into a hand. So we get about 40,000 winner. And Doyle's favorite saying always is, well, let's cut them in half, which means double the stakes. Instead of being 40 points, why don't you make them 20? And now we're paying 2 and 4,000. And then we get about 100 winner, and he cuts them in half, and now we're playing 4 and 8,000 a hand. And then we play an 8 and 16,000 a hand, and he gets about 200,000 winner.
And I said, stuck.
Stuck, right? Yeah. Stuck. And I said, Doyle, I said, why don't we go home? We've been here, play golf all day. He said, oh, God damn it! Every time you get $2 winner, you want to go home. He says, but before we do any more gambling, says I'm gonna check you two guys out. Says this KB on the square says, ain't no way you two son of bitches could ever beat me, he says. So he gets down to Chip, and he says, and I'm sure you've probably heard about, but back in those days, a popular thing for cheating was what they called a peep, which would be something they put in the ceiling. They could look down and see your cards, and then they'd radio the guy that's playing. He'd have an earpiece and tell him what cards you had in your hand, so it was unbeatable. So anyway, he makes Chip get down on the floor, and I have to do this because it's like to really embellish the story.
Wait, we won't be able to hear you unless okay. You keep the mic. Well,
anyway, Doyle gets down on between Chip's legs, and he's feeling all around, and he says, well, this one's clean. He says, all right, big boy, call me big boy. He weighed about 350 at the time.
He says, how much did you weigh?
I was about 220. I had a bigger stomach then than I do now, which that's another story. That's the Spilotro story.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that next.
So anyway, he gets down, he checks me all out, and he says, well, I guess you're all right, too. So let's go, let's play, let's shuffle up and deal. So we start back playing. We were late. The place closes up. They lock us in the building and everything. About 4:30 in the morning, he's 850,000 loose, which is a lot of money around 1980.
it's a lot of money today.
It's not chump change today. It takes Richard almost 2 weeks to earn that much these days.
So anyway, I hate to say this. He finally imploded. He went crazy and he got mad. And he says, God damn it, I don't need no partner to take this fat son of a bitch you're talking about, Chip, and beat me out of all my fucking money, he says. I hope his language is not too bad.
It's all right, yeah.
But anyway, he says, I'll straighten up with you Monday, he said. And by the way, we ain't partners no more. I don't need no partner to beat me out of all my money like this. So he says, oh, before I go, give me that football sheet out of your pocket. So he wants the pro. Back then, there were only like 14 teams. So he looks at him and says, give me this, 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 this. He bets all 14 games, $40,000 a game. I said, all right. He said, I'll see you Monday. We'll straighten up then. Our business is done. So that's how we split up. And, of course, he went 11-2-1, I think, winners. So he won all the money back that I had won.
So you and Doyle broke even, and Chip had a good day.
Chip had a good day, and that's that story of.
I thought he made you guys strip naked.
Well, I mean, basically he did. He's reaching up your pants looking for wires and everything. I mean, he didn't make us take our clothes off, but we were, you know, he inspected us.
Okay.
But that's that story, and that's a true story, and you can ask anybody. I can say this on the radio. Doyle can't deny any part of it because I haven't embellished it one bit.
Now,
he don't like this story either, but it's a true story.
Now, you and Doyle were partners for at least a while in a bookmaking.
Like 4 years.
And there's a mobster with the name of Tony Spilotro.
Yes.
Who was a piece of work. One day, he called you up, said, want to talk about it. So what happened?
Well, I was at home in the Regency Towers, and the phone, he called on the house phone. And, Billy, this is Tony. And he had the most unusual eyes anybody ever saw. He could look at you like look a hole through you, but you couldn't do that for the phone, but... When he was in person, he was pretty intimidating. Anyway, he says, I need to talk to you. I said, well, Tony, it's 10:30 at night. He says, I need to talk to you tonight. I want you to meet me at Winchell's Donut Shop up on Tropicana. I believe that was where we met. So I go there. I told my wife, I says, I'm going to meet a very bad guy. She said, well, why would you go? I said, well, I think I have to. I says, I got to go. She said, well, that sounds stupid to me if you... I said, well, might be worse if I don't come. So anyway, I go. He said, we'll just get right to the point. He says, you and Fatso, y'all been booking around here for 2 or 3 years, which he bet too, and he was always losing, and he always paid, incidentally.
He was a customer.
He was a customer. He says, from now on, I got 25% of every bet you and Billy book here in this town.
Billy. You said Doyle. You and Billy. You mean you and Doyle.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Every 25% of every bet you and Doyle book here in this town, he says. And you tell that big, fat, puzzle-gut partner of yours, if I catch him booking one bet in this town that I ain't got 25% of, I'm going to stick 12 ice picks in that big, fat, puzzle-gut belly of his. He said, now you tell him what I said. So, you know, I guess I was coming from, didn't know too much about the mob because I probably said the wrong thing. Then I said, well, you know, I don't think he's going to like that too much. And he says,
good, yeah.
That was ground to kill you right there. And he says, you just tell him what I said. So anyway, Doyle's knew I was meeting him. So the next morning, I says, not tonight, Doyle. I'll talk to you in the morning. So we meet for breakfast. He said, what'd he say? What'd he say? So I said, Doyle, he said, he told me he's going to take 25% of all the bets that we take here in this town. He told me to tell you, he said, tell that big, fat, puzzle-gut partner of yours, if I catch him betting one, booking one bet in this town that I ain't got 25% of, I'm going to stick 12 ice picks in that big, fat, puzzle-gut belly of his. And Doyle just sat there a minute, and he looked over at me, and my stomach was bigger than his now. And he looked at me, and he says, what's wrong with your stomach? Which I thought was a pretty good line. So we
this is a big problem, though.
Oh, it's a real big problem. So we happened to have a Doyle was very friendly with the Binions and all, and Benny Binion was a pretty tough guy too, and had a pretty good reputation. So we went to Benny, and he says, "You boys really got yourself in a mess here. I tell you, that's a bad man y'all fooling with." He said, "But if you can get him come down here, I'll at least talk to him." So we got together, and Doyle talked to Benny and Jack, and Tony agreed to go down there. And he went down there, and Benny couldn't handle it any better. He didn't tell him he had to do anything. He just said, you know, these are pretty good old boys, and, you know, they kind of friends of ours, and they're not with us, but they kind of with us. He says, is there any kind of way you could give them a pass? And he looked at Benny, and he says, you know, Benny, I'm going to do that for you. He said, I'm going to give these boys a pass. And that's how we got away from that. But he was still around, and he was just a dangerous guy. And but that's the end of that story. But shortly thereafter that, there was a lot of heat around because of him and because of Jimmy Shager had come to town, who was a dope dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And the feds, we were all playing golf for big money and all, and the helicopters were flying, like in the movie Casino and all. You know, it said Spilotro was out there playing golf, but he didn't really play golf. He just bet. That was us out there. That was me, Doyle, and all the rest of the guys, Jack Strauss and all. We were bet playing the golf.
Puggy.
And Puggy. And we were all, everybody was betting on us and against us and all. And so we got a lot of heat from that, and we realized it, and we actually quit about a month later. I got out of the bookmaking business, and me and we quit, and it was I went into the betting end of it. Then I go from one spot to another, and I started just when I started messing with boxing and all, but that's how I got out of the bookmaking business.
And this was about 70
this would have been around around 80.
Run 80?
All this stuff was happening pretty close at the same time.
You know, one of the things that amazes me about that is that even at that time, by 1980, that Benny Binion still had that much weight.
Well, you
or
know
that
what
much
it
power.
You know what it was Benny had a was very tactful. Like I said, the way if he'd have handled that any other way, it probably wouldn't have worked. Because first thing Tony said when we asked him about going down there, his first comment was, oh, y'all got that old motherfucker involved. And but then he went down there anyway. You follow me? But that's what he said, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, Benny just asked him in a nice, he says, is there any way you could give these boys a pass? He didn't say, I'd like for you to, You have to. He didn't say nothing. He said, is there any way? You know, and I don't think he was looking to get no fight started. He just gave him an opportunity. And I think Tony took it as an opportunity to just leave things status quo, and he had things pretty much around town under control. And Benny was kind of at an age where he was fading out, but he was Benny was not one to have against you, I don't think. Benny was more action than he was words. I mean, the stories I've heard about Benny was that he would get the job done if it was necessary.
Yeah, but there was that one guy he tried to kill like 9 times or something before the guy actually got killed.
Those were different times. It's unbelievable. I look back on that and I can't even remember. I can't even imagine how. I mean, the alternatives were, I guess you had to leave here and just disappear if you didn't want to do what Spilotro did. I mean, at one time he had chip under his thumb. All the good players, he muscled all the poker players, the good players. And Chip finally got away from him some kind of way. I don't know how he did it or whatever, but I'll tell you another quick story on Spilotro.
Please do.
Sarge Ferris, Hall of Famer, mm-hmm. poker player. Scared to death of Spilotro. And he was the gutsiest gambler I believe I ever met in my whole life, Fred Ferris. He was no limit poker. He was the most fearless player I ever met. Anyway, he comes to me one day. Billy, I need you to do me a favor. I said, what's that, Sarge? He said, I want you to play me gin rummy. I'm going to lose $500,000 to you, and I'm going to give you 20% for doing it. You can make $100,000. It won't take us but a few hours. And, I knew that Spilotro had him under control, and I know what he's trying to do. He's trying to shuff off some money that he don't have to pay Tony half of, I guess, or what to show him a loss, because I guess he'd been winning. You know. So he says, we'll just play a few hours. You make 20% just between you and I. And at the time of my life, I was probably at my best shape in life. I was doing really well with everything I'd ever done and young, and I thought about it a second, and $100,000 was a lot of money back then. I said, Sarge, I tell you, I'm going to pass. I says, but stay in touch. Anyway, I passed because I thought about that. I says, you know, if Tony got any suspicion of that, Sarge was so scary of him, he might threaten and say, and he'd admit to it, say, yeah, I did it, and then Tony come kill me, you know, and leave Sarge alone, you know.
Tony didn't try to cut into you anyway?
He never tried to muscle me for poker, ever, but I guess maybe, and I was beating the No Limit Deuce game all the time, which for some reason, he had a lot of, I don't know, I had a good relationship with him through the bookmaking. He took me as like an opportunity to win a lot of money through the bookman, because he thought he could win and he bet everything, and he always paid. You know, my dealings with him were good. And he was always a gentleman with me, except he had a nice way about him, but yet when the cards were on the line and he decided to change things, he could be deadly. I mean, his weapon of choice, you know, he liked to put people's head in the vice. I don't know if you ever heard that story, and he just turns it to the eyes pop out on the table. That's the way he liked to make you decide you wanted to do whatever he's asking.
It would make me decide.
You know, I had a friend back then who I think he either owned or he used to hang out in the place called the Chateau Vegas, which was over on DI.
Right.
And I had a friend who liked to go in there and drink late at night. And Spilotro would be in there at the bar 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, my friend was a, you know, generous kind of guy, and he said to the bartender, buy that guy a drink. And Tony Spilotro said, you know, I am the last guy in the world you want to buy a drink for. And my friend said, why? And he said, because if you do the rest of your life, the FBI is going to be following you around. Now, my friend didn't even know who he was.
Right,
just the guy at the bar, you know.
Right.
We'll get back to Billy following a few commercials. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. Every Thursday in September, starting tonight, September 1st, 25 people get to spin the wheel in the $500,000 Big Spin and Win promotion. If your name is called over the loudspeaker, which may be heard all over the casino, you have 4 minutes to make your way to the showroom. The wheel has prizes of $1,000, $5,000, $10,000, and $25,000, with an average of $4,250. After each week's drawing, you may start earning tickets for next week's drawing. Each day, there's a maximum of 1,600 tickets you may earn, $1 per ticket for video poker, $1 for 4 tickets for reels, from midnight to midnight. Starting about a half hour after the drawing on Thursday night, you may earn additional 1,600 tickets before midnight. Last year, when the contest finished, they were under the guaranteed amount. Just not as many $25,000 hits happened as they were expecting. So they kept drawing names 5 at a time until they exceeded the amount they promised to give away. This is a really cool gesture that you don't typically see at other casinos. Since the day for this promotion is midnight to midnight, if the hours work for you, you can go late at night, finish up your 1,600 points just before midnight, and then once the witching hour strikes, start on tomorrow's 1,600 points. Keep in mind that the casino day goes from 3 a.m. to 3 a.m., so if you play exactly 1,600 points before midnight, your score will actually read 3,200 points when you've played enough after midnight to get the maximum entries. Next week's free video poker class, Wednesday, September 7th at noon, is 9-6 Bonus Poker Deluxe. Bonus Poker Deluxe is similar to Jack's or Better, except you get quite a bit more for all four of a kinds and only single money for two pair. This makes the strategy between the games quite similar, but certainly not identical. Classes will be held in the Silverado Lounge, which is immediately in front of Don Vito's restaurant. At the Palms, from now until the end of September, they have drawings every Saturday night at 7:15. Winners share $10,000 each night. Every day, Monday through Friday, you can swipe to receive 20 free drawing entries. Ending tomorrow, there is a multiplier for everybody. In video poker, it is either going to be 2x or 3x. You're limited to 80,000 bonus points for the promotion. PFP, Play for Prizes. From September 5th through the 16th, you earn Albertsons gift cards. Albertsons is a grocery store, supermarket. For the last 2 weeks of the month, you earn TJ Maxx gift cards. Prizes are redeemed at a rate of 0.2% up to $190 per day. You keep the points. Every Sunday in September, you earn double points on video poker and 10x on reels. And video reels, no limits on points you can earn. Wednesdays, you earn free car wash. Tuesdays, you earn for 500 points free Brendan movie tickets. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is 100 Play with Quick Quads. This is a frequent game of the week, and I've addressed it numerous times in this spot, so we're going to skip the description today. Several weeks ago on this show, I mentioned that the vice president of VideoPoker.com, Mike Fields, had a son, Connor Fields, competing in the BMX cycling event at the Olympics, and I was really excited because I've heard about Connor since he was born, and I've actually met him. Turns out Connor won. I wrote about it in my weekly blog, which you can read at gamblingwithanedge.com. We're hoping to get Connor on this show if we can. He has lots of interview requests, and we're hoping he says yes to us. All right, let's go back to interviewing Billy Baxter.
Now, you mentioned a couple minutes ago about boxing. Now, you were manager. You managed Floyd Mayweather's uncle, who's world champion Roger Mayweather.
No, wait a minute. Oh, little Floyd. Okay. I get see both the father and the son are both named Floyd, so I get them confused. Go ahead.
You're right. Okay, good. So you managed a world champion, Roger Mayweather, number of years, and several others. Do you still keep up to date on boxing and what's happening?
You know, I kind of ran out of things to do there when I was in the bookmaking business and got out and I was betting and all. But the reason I got into the boxing simply was I'd go to the gym scouting to decide who I was going to bet on. And I went in there one day and this young kid was in there, Roger Mayweather. He'd come out here 19 years old. I think he got thrown out of the Olympic trials for taunting or whatever. He had a kind of a bad attitude. He was killing everybody in the gym down there. And I asked somebody, I said, who is that kid? And they said, well, that's Roger Mayweather. I said, have you ever had a pro? He said, no, he never even had a pro fight. He just come out here, he's looking for a manager. So I went over there and I talked to him and I signed him the next day. And his 13th fight, he became world champion. He was unbelievable to start with. And we fought a guy by the name of Sammy Serrano in San Juan, Puerto Rico, in Roberto Clemente Stadium in front of 40,000 people. And it was pretty intimidating for a black fight. You know, Puerto Ricans, they kind of don't get along with the blacks too much. And when we came in under the stadium, they threw the beer cups full of pee on our heads coming into the stadium. Jesus. And everything. Their opening statements were, he's going to kill your black ass and that sort of stuff. So it's pretty intimidating for a young kid. Anyway, Roger winds up knocking him out in the 8th round of the fight. But there was more to that story. I'll just tell you how even boxing was back in those days. We were with Don King. He's the one that got us secured the fight for us, to fight for the title at that earlier stage. I told him, I said, he will win for sure. You get us the fight, we'll win it. So we go down there and we had the weigh-in. There was a guy back in those days named Pepe Cordero. He was like the bag man, so to speak, for the WBA, which is the World Boxing Association. Back in those days, you had to pay to be ranked. It was all pretty corrupt. And we get on the scales for 130 pounds. And, of course, Roger weighed in and made the weight. And then Serrano comes in. He gets on the scale, and the thing, boom, and it goes to the top and bangs. I don't know what he weighed, 137, 38, whatever. And they take him off the scale. I said, oh, wait a minute. He ain't even come close. And they hand him a cup of soup, and he just starts drinking it down. And I said, what's going on here? You got to weigh this guy in. And they said, if you don't want to fight, go back to the States. Get the fuck out of here. And they just completely muscled us. That's just the way they did business. And Cordero was there the way. He was a big guy, weighed about 450 pounds. And so anyway, Roger knocked him out in the 8th round to win the fight. And he hadn't lost a fight in 10 years. You can check the record books on all that. But
it's because he had a good manager, huh?
Well, I mean, I knew he was an exception. That's the reason I put him in that early. He was ready at that age. And from there, I got Vernon Forrest, who became welterweight champion of the world, beat Shane Mosley twice. I had
Your timing was wrong.
I had Bruce Curry, who was Donald Curry's brother, who was super welterweight champion of the world, 140 pounds. I had three world champions there in a matter of about 2 or 3 years. I was voted manager of the year here in Nevada. And I was very active in it and had a lot of fun with it, but it kind of got old after a while, and I got out of it.
There wasn't the paydays back then the way there is today.
No, they weren't making the kind of money they make today. But, I mean, Mayweather fought Chavez twice. You know, he made over $1 million for those fights, but that's nothing compared to today.
Today they have mixed martial arts, UFC among others. Now this... Do you think that style of fighting will replace boxing in terms of either fan popularity or betting?
I'll tell you what they've done. They come up with a great marketing plan, and I think what they've done, the way they're doing it, it is pushing boxing to the back burner, and there's a reason. And it's something that I've always disagreed with, but it's the way boxing has always been for many years. And the reason is this. You get a guy, he's an Olympic, great fighter. They put him in, bum, 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 bum. He gets to 17, 18 and 0, and he still ain't fought nobody. They just win. You never have a fight. Every fight, they're 50 to 1. And that's the way they bring fighters up in the boxing business. They build a record, and the big thing is to keep the zero, and you're an undefeated fighter and all. Well, they do just the opposite in the MMA. It's unbelievable. You win the title, the next fight, you're fighting the biggest killer they can find from anywhere on the face of the earth. These guys, it's impossible for them to last over four or five fights. Once they get into those fights where it's brutal, human body is just not made to absorb that kind of punishment. You see some of those fights. Both fighters at the end of the fight, there's blood everywhere. They beat, so their ears are all puffed in. This is like you can only last so many fights. And that concept is very popular with fans, and then rightly so, because every fight is a fight. And in boxing, you go to the card, they might have seven stinkers on the card and then a main event, which is maybe pretty competitive. And so as far as the interest, even my own interest, I didn't like the MMA to start with because I'm a boxing guy, I have to tell you. I've started watching it now because they're real fights. And, you know, just because a guy just won the championship and they say he's fighting so-and-so, pretty good chance. He's only $1.80. If these boxers, these world champions, they're like Bolt last night was 55-1 to win the 200 meters last night. That's what they are, 55-1. Who wants to pay to go see that?
Right.
I mean, who cares?
Well, actually, I enjoy seeing Bolt run. Usain Bolt in the Olympics is different, but yes.
Yeah, but that's what I was. Oh, I'm just saying that I was
no, yeah, but I was Mayweather fighting that last guy he fought.
Yeah, I mean, what's the point of it? Yeah. Who wants to pay $100 to see that? I mean, I know what's going to happen. He's going to win every round. He's going to outbox him. And that's going to be the end of the story. And that's even at the top levels. But at the beginning levels coming up, the cards are terrible. They're terrible. So for that reason, they got to be, unless boxing starts coming. Now, I've noticed NBC has started putting on some fights, and they're putting real fights together. Well, that's what people will watch. They're not going to watch you build fighters. But in the boxing game before, they had the mentality that that's how you do it. You had to build the fighters' records, and then you make the money later on. People that come out and pay their money, they want to go see the gladiators fight. They want to see the rib. They don't want to know the winner before they walk in the building. They want to know, I don't know whose arm's going to get broke tonight.
Yeah, they used to have boxing at the Silver Slipper.
I went to every show there ever was.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why they don't do that. I guess it doesn't draw anymore. But
it would go if people wanted. I actually promoted 10 cards at the Dunes when Roger was first starting in order to get him fights. That's how I got him to be a champion so fast.
All right, let's change it up a little bit. You have 7 World Series of Poker rings. Do you still enjoy playing tournaments? Did you play in the World Series this year?
Yeah, I did. I played. I still enjoy playing. The problem is the hours. Just too long for a guy. I'll be 76 next month, and they start to add up on you. And the reason these young guys wind up at the final tables is the older guys just can't hack it day after day after day after day. You know, every now and then somebody will slip through if they catch exceptional cards or whatever. But it's a young man's game too, and so I like to play cash. But I like to play tournaments too, just for the challenge of it. I actually played the online World Series of Poker, but actually came in, I want to say 17th, or it could have been 27th, I'm not sure, out of about 1,100. And the first prize was 500. It was a pretty big tournament. The first prize was over $500,000. And it was, I played a few of the tournaments, mostly the lowball events and all, but I didn't do all that great. But anyway, it was fun. I enjoy it still.
if you could play 4 or 5 hours a day, how would you like your chances against the younger lowball players of today?
Well, I still play lowball today with the younger players, and I have a certain mix of games, of the lowball games, and they all know it. I like to play heads up too, so I pretty much play most anybody heads up if they want to play the mix that I want to play, which is all lowball games. And there's some we play, and they're good, and I win sometime and I lose sometime. But I still play heads up for six. I go a good 6 hours, and I'm available for that.
The word is out. He's available.
I can tell you the mix right now. Here, this goes for we'll play triple draw. They all like that. We'll play Badoogie. We'll play No limit deuce if they have to have a cap on it. I know they like to play sissy poker, so we can put some kind of $15,000 or $20,000 cap on that. And we play ace to the 5 limit and deuce to the 7 limit. Play those 5 games. I'm ready to play.
Do they have to play them all, or can they say?
Play all 5 of them.
All right. Now, you gamble at lots of things and have. Now, relatively speaking, how much of successful gambling is being good at the games, and how much is getting the right odds before you sit down to play?
Well, obviously you have to be good at the games, but it helps for you to be better at whatever games you're playing than your opponents, because there is a certain element of luck. But luck over the long haul, that'll even out. So I don't think about the luck factor. I mean, yeah, you're going to have bad beats, and you can blame it on bad luck or bad cards or whatever. But if you play consistently every day and you play good, and you're going to get the money. It's just that simple. It's not a game of luck. But that's why everybody loves it, because there is a luck element, and you can have the days where the guy that's not that good can beat the guy that's very good. But it's not going to happen every day or often enough.
Yeah, good. So that part is all true. But for a while, Tiger Woods was the best golfer in the world. With the right spot of so many points or holes, you could play him even, or you could play him where you had the advantage.
And would have when I was young. I don't play golf anymore. I played a lot of pros when I was young, golf, you know what I mean? And because I knew what I could do, and I'd have a pretty good idea what they could do. I'd just give them a 64 and match up from there. And, you know, I'd match up to where they could shoot 64 and tie. And so if they could shoot better than that, God bless them.
All right. Now, back in the 70s, the backgammon craze went through Vegas and other places. Did you ever get caught up in that?
I did. I tried backgammon. I wasn't that good. They had to spot me. I know you want to hear about cheating, so that's one of the times I got cheated. I was playing this guy. I won't call his name. I don't even know if he's still alive. But we were playing out by the Dunes pool. And anyway, we were playing, and he was beating me, and anyway, he threw the dice. I had him all boxed in, and he needs double sixes to escape. And he threw the dice out there, and the dice just kind of stood up on the table. They was like, and I noticed he had his cigarette. He smoked. He had a cigarette pack in his hand, so he had magnets in the cigarette pack. So I grabbed the cigarette pack and the magnets fell out of the table. So we were playing at the Dunes pool too. So anyway, that was the end of that match. But I wasn't that good a backgammon player.
I got cheated. I don't mind saying his name. There was a guy in town named Mike Maxiculli who everybody sort of – he ran the backgammon club here in town.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you remember him or not. He was a good friend of Chip's.
I didn't know him. No.
But, yeah. Yeah, I got cheated by him out of $14,000 one night. But he had a metal cigar case, but he would hold it up underneath the board.
Mm-hmm.
And
that would hold them down better.
Yeah, yeah.
This guy, the dice come like they wanted to come up in the air.
Yeah.
But you couldn't get too close to him, and he got it too close that time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Back in L.A. when I was playing in the 70s, Gabby Horowitz had his techniques. A guy named Steve Goldman had his magnetized table. And very good. Billy, it's been a pleasure talking to you. These stories are great. Sexton is right. You're a great storyteller. This was fun. Hope we can do it again another couple years.
Well, let's not wait that long.
Well, there's always great stories, and you run out of your favorite stories after a while. But these stories are great. I'm sure our listeners enjoyed it. And our earlier show was in January of 2015. And it was more this kind of a freewheeling show where Billy has lots of great stories. This is fun.
Richard, how can people get in touch with us?
Well, first of all, I want to say we welcome your questions. Please send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. Or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. You can get the show delivered to you automatically every week. Just sign up to do that at iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or at gamblingwithanedge.com. To find an archive of every episode we've ever done, you can find that at bobdancer.com.
Thank you, Billy Baxter. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.